Rosie, I'm so happy to meet you here in my space. I was thrilled to meet you at a friend's house and become aware of the power of this amazing woman. I am so drawn to people who are unique and authentic, and you truly are an extraordinary example of that. So thank you for being here. Then fast forward to, so I love the story of how you came to this big transition in your life. But before that, what was the lead up to this job that you were closing this big deal on and having 14 weeks vacation? Where did you grow up? Tell us about your education.
Thank you. Well, so really, you know, I got to start with my mom. Before I ever talk about myself, I have to talk about my mom. And she recently passed away. So it's still very raw for me. And that fire that I've had my entire life is just so much stronger now. So it really started with her. So my parents came from Mexico to California in 1958. And they came to this town of Hayward, California, which is in the Bay Area, not part of Silicon Valley, because my dad was a seasonal worker at the Hunt's Tomato Factory in Hayward. And so that year, my parents got married and decided to make that their new home. They came legally and started their life there. Now, my dad was abusive, and my mom made the very hard decision as a strong Catholic and as a very, very strong woman to leave him after giving birth to 9 children. So I am the 6th of 9. We're all very close in age. So there's only an 11-year age difference between my oldest brother and my youngest sister. So that was a tough decision for her, and it was the right decision. Mm-hmm. And she could have gone back to Mexico. She stayed in this country because she knew that we could have a better life mm-hmm. there. And so we were raised in our village, and it was our Catholic church, our Catholic faith, where we're all able to go to, all 9 of us, to 12 years of Catholic school. And I do think that that emphasis on education was the ticket. It really was, and is, still is. And somehow my mom managed to send all 9 of us off to college and still had an amazing career, her own career.
Well, and what was that?
She spent her entire career finding jobs for the disadvantaged at Catholic Charities. So different constituencies, but she ended it leading this program called 55 Plus, so finding people jobs over 55 years old. And it was really great because at her recent funeral service, my sister and I took her beautiful stories and her collections of files that we went through. And one of the things, you know, she gave me that box, do not open until after I pass away box. And in this box was just an homage to our family, but an homage to her. And like in this one file was, you know, her resumes, how they evolved over time and how she kept getting these promotions and her evaluations were in there. And it was great. And this other file was her business cards, all the jobs that she had over time, all again with Catholic Charities. And then this one file that I love the most, and it was the thickest file, of course, were all these handwritten thank you notes of all the people she's ever touched. Not just the ones she found jobs for, but mm-hmm. the ones that she was the neighborhood translator, the neighborhood driver, the neighborhood, you know, she even provided vaccinations right. for people. I mean, she was the person. She was the one that did everything, not just for us, but for the community. And I got to tell you, what was more telling about her service was, of course, I received a lovely letter from the president who adored my mom mm-hmm. and who remembered her name every time he saw her. But I also received a letter from the president of Notre Dame University who remembered my mom because it's a funny, funny story. And I had told him that she was sick. And so when she passed, he sent this mm-hmm. letter. But the long and short of it is he spent his first year out of the seminary at our parish. And my mom made such an impact on him that he remembered her, 50 years mm-hmm. later? It's just like her legacy is huge.
It's listening to your story, I have stories about my mother too, and the extraordinary, courageous, adventurous, especially from my mother's age group. I'm older than you are. She could have run a huge corporation had it been another time. And women with the ability that your mother had, my mother, still managed to affect not only their neighborhood, but their town, the village, the church. They really impacted human beings. And it didn't get wasted on us, for sure. Absolutely. And nine children, and just did it on her own. I am just, you are so lucky. I'm so lucky.
I am absolutely lucky. She had nothing and gave us everything. And so at her service, my sister and I put together this kind of "This Is Your Life" set of storyboards. And it was so great to have her friends and, you know, her family come into this reception and just see this huge, gigantic wall of these storyboards of her life. It was just, it was the best service.
I did a similar thing for my mother too. She was an artist too, so I had all of her art and all of the things that she'd done for people. And it really is a great privilege. We are privileged in the most special way to have not only that gene pool, but to have that influence without ever being taught that this is the way to be, but just watching the way you should be.
No, that's exactly right. No, that's, and look, I mean, it's a story of values more than anything. You know, it's interesting. I'm not exactly as Catholic perhaps as we were raised, but again, to believe in something, and I believed in her, right? I believed in her is what I believed in. And it's interesting if you think about that time period. Look, I was born in 1965. And so I was raised in an era of change, profound change in this country. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just what was happening, what you saw on TV, it was happening in my own home, right? For my mom to feel empowered in a way that our country and women in particular have never felt empowered before, that she found that strength in herself. Yeah. And I think that strength was always there, but you know, it was a desperate choice that she had to make, right? It was for our safety and her safety that she did what she did. But she also, again, as I mentioned, made the conscientious effort to stay in this country where she knew very few people, and, you know, except for her village, right? But think about what's happening during that time and the way we grew up. You know, I'm one of six girls, and our view of feminism, was through a very narrow lens. What was happening on TV, right? What was happening on TV was bra burning and, you know, abortion rights and contraception. And look, again, coming from a very faith-based community, that wasn't exactly embraced. It wasn't exactly embraced.
Right.
And so, you know, the only thing I can think of growing up, you know, as 10 years old, et cetera, was, oh my God, they're all going to hell, right? What I didn't realize is that feminism was around me the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was personified in my mom.
Yeah.
And that's what I think people don't understand about that era.
Mm-hmm.
And that era giving a voice to so many people like my mom. And so I think, you know, when the history books are written and when we think about this era of feminism, it has to be all of it. It has to be all of these heroes.
Yeah.
These heroes that found their own voices. I mean, think about you. Can I just do this for a second? Just for a second, because again, I remember you like it was yesterday. And I remember when you first came out, and look, it was, you know, I was what, 8 years old, I think, when you first came out with, you know, the parachute suits, right? But think about that. That was 1973. You did that before women were legally allowed to apply for their own credit card.
Yes,
that's,
I remember
that's crazy.
It well. I remember it well because I was in business and I was married and I believed, like everybody else, that the man runs the business until I realized that I couldn't stay in a bad situation like your mother, different story, and that I had to leave with $95 to my
name. Oh, my God.
And I couldn't get a loan. I couldn't get, I had to borrow from friends and anybody that knew me, and I was sort of quiet and hidden away. But it was a time that exploded with an energy for women to start a conversation. But because you had this extraordinary woman who was an example that you saw every day, now, did she speak fluent English?
So the way we grew up, so yes, but we grew up with my mom spoke Spanish to us and we spoke English back. So it was kind of important. She felt it was very important. Obviously, yeah. We all thought so, to, of course, right. To learn the language, to be fluent in the language. But yes, she was fluent, though, absolutely.
So my mother...
And learned it here, by the way.
My mother was Lebanese, but she grew up in Puerto Rico because they traveled and traded, and her father left her mother and five girls in Puerto Rico. And so my mother's language was Spanish, and she married a Spanish man that she met at the World Trade at the big, you know, World
United Nations.
No, like the big events. I'm forgetting.
World's Fair.
And so they spoke Spanish, but when I was born, she said, no, these kids are going to assimilate. And so, unfortunately, my Spanish is sample room Spanish. So I can talk about clothes in Spanish.
Yeah,
But I really appreciate that she understood that we would need to assimilate.
Yeah.
And that we would need to get a great education. Yeah. Just the way your mother clearly made that an effort, not only to get you through high school, but then, I mean, how she did that.
Assimilation was also a very big concept in the 70s too, right? I mean, that's when, I mean, look, that's, you know, we as a Latinx community still have to choose white in the census data, right? And that was a concerted effort for assimilation for the Latino community back then. Even though, again, I got to tell you, the first time I found my dad's birth certificate, and the birth certificate, my birth certificate, and it, on there, it shows that my dad was white. And I'm thinking, wait, my dad looks like Martin Luther King. The first thought when I first found that, I was probably 7 years old, was, oh my God, that's not my real dad. That was my first thought, because I'm thinking, wait,
why? So crazy.
Right? Because think about that. Yeah. My dad was not white. He was not white. But yet, we had to check that box.
Well, what does somebody who's Lebanese check? My father was Basque and Lebanese, and my mother was Lebanese. And so I don't know what box to check either.
Like, yeah.
What, I don't know.
Yeah. We're still evolving as a nation, right? That's for sure.
You know what? I think over it all, how lucky we are.
Absolutely.
We checked boxes that didn't make sense.
Yeah.
But we created our own checks and our own, establish our own identity.
Absolutely.
So that the box may be not as important for us at that time.
That's right.
We certainly. But so your education, what did you choose to study?
Yeah. I have to go back to my champions again. So here's what happens. I worked full time in high school. In fact, I was the family breadwinner at the time. I had this amazing job at the county library headquarters. So I thought I won the lottery because I had access to any book I ever wanted. And it was the central place where all the books came to before they went to the branches. So you name the book, and I was obsessed with Shakespeare.
Goodness.
I was obsessed with science fiction. I couldn't get enough books. I just couldn't. And that was my window to the world.
Wow.
So I would work at this place, at Alameda County Library Services. I worked from 3 to 9 every day. Weekends, and then I would come home and I would, change, eat dinner, and start my homework at 10 p.m. 10 to 1, that was my schedule. 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. was my homework schedule, and then start again the next day. And I you know, no one should have to work full-time in high school, but at the same time, it wasn't the worst life.
No.
Again, I loved my job. Uh-huh. I loved school. It was my life. Yeah. But I'll never forget what happened my junior year in high school. This woman by the name of Lisa Quiros from New York, most recently headed up the Time Warner Foundation. At that time, she was, she already graduated from Harvard. She was working in the admissions office. And, you know, they scout by looking at your PSAT scores. Mm-hmm. So I got the call. And I took the PSAT. And she says to me, she says, "Hi, my name is Lisa Quiros. Have you ever thought about applying to Harvard?" And this is how arrogant I was as a junior in high school. Right. Good God. Look, I lived in Silicon Valley, born and raised. And if you're going to go anywhere, you're going to Stanford. You know, I lived on the other side of the San Mateo Bridge, and Stanford was just on the other, across the bay. If you're going to make it, that's where you're going to
go. Right.
That's where you're going. So I said to her, I said, you know, thank you. Thank you so much. But no. I'm going to Stanford. Who did I think I was? And then she said to me, she says, look, you know, we'll waive the admissions fee, which I think was $50 at the time. $50 is my life savings, right?
Right.
We'll waive the admissions fee. You have nothing to lose. Why don't you just go ahead and apply? You can make your decision when you make your decision.
Right.
Great. All right, sure. So, you know, back then we were doing our applications on typewriters, right? So I did. I applied to Harvard, Stanford, and Berkeley. And I'll never forget, you know, back then you knew exactly when the admissions decisions were coming in by mail, right? So I remember the day that it was going to happen, and I came home, and I walked in the door, and I heard my mom crying. My mom never cries. I heard her crying in the kitchen, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I didn't get in. My first thought, I didn't get in. So I walk into the kitchen, and she was crying because I got in.
Oh, okay.
So it was a big decision. Again, I was the family breadwinner. I was very close to my family. But I also knew at that time it was the best decision that I could make.
Yeah.
And it is what led my mom to start a career at Catholic Charities. So there I was. I started Harvard in 1983. I helped my mom before I left put together her resume, you know, kind of thought her through about some options, and she didn't get this job. She started working in 1984.
That's
her
so
career
great.
Just took off from
That's
there.
That's so great.
So in some ways, right, it took that level of shock, if you will, shock to the system, to also empower her. And she found her own voice.
I really believe working as soon as you can gives you a sense of how it's going to be, you know, what the reality is when you get out there. So the education you choose is really done through a different lens than some sort of mystical job, and you have no idea of what that will be until you get there. But I think the idea then of your mother looking, how old was she at that point?
At the time, let's see, that was 1983, so she was what, 30, 35?
So 35. I really think, even now more than ever, that a woman's opportunity to work at different phases, like I think 35 is a big turning point for women in what they do in 30, that 35 to 45, but then 50 is the big one.
Yeah, actually, it's 45, sorry.
45, but that's that big, and then 50, so she started 45, so she was just building to 50, right?
Yeah.
And 50, from my vision of this, is 50 and forward is the best time.
Absolutely.
It is the best time.
Absolutely, and let me just put this in perspective. First of all, she had been working, so we were, talk about the village, one of the jobs that she had, many jobs, one, she catered weddings with her amazing tamales. She catered a lot of activities with those tamales,
right.
So, and very, very hard work, so she sold tamales. And then the other was, she did a lot of aftercare, after school care. So we had, you know, half a dozen kids, maybe more, at our house after school.
That's so great.
So, you know, again, we all worked. And, you know, my siblings worked. We all worked.
Yeah.
So we all worked very, very young, usually at 14.
Yeah.
So we all contributed. We all, you know, had a job to do, if you will. But having that full-time job that she needed to do starting at the age of 45 was probably one of the best things that ever happened to her.
Yeah.
How she, and here's the thing. I'll never forget my uncle, who's 2 years younger than she is, and her best friend, and of course spoke at her eulogy. He's a missionary in Haiti, a Marist brother.
Wow.
Still working at 83 as, mm-hmm. as a missionary. But he spoke at her eulogy. He said a eulogy recently, and he talked about, you know, my mom, who literally had no formal education. Her brothers mm-hmm. did. Her brothers were all sent off to, of course, these great schools.
Yeah.
But she was the oldest girl, and her responsibility was to the homestead. And eventually she went off to help her aunt, who was a mother superior, run an orphanage in the middle of Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico. That was her school. And so she really didn't have any formal mm-hmm. education. So when you think about someone who came from nothing except her grit and her courage and her fortitude mm-hmm. and her persistence and perseverance, all of that together to take on the world the way she did
right.
and succeed in the yeah. way she did. So as my uncle was talking about this at her eulogy about, you know, coming to this foreign land, coming from nothing and building everything, not just in what she built in her kids, but investing in herself,
mm-hmm.
it's the best thing she ever did.
Yeah, yeah. And so what was the, so your mother and father decided to come to a strange place.
Yeah.
Did they know anybody, or they just came?
No.
They didn't know anybody.
No, I mean, we had some distant, very, very distant people we would call cousins, but there were, you know, there were some folks that I think became part of this village, and they came into it. So and it kind of evolved over time. Mm-hmm.
I really admire, deeply admire people who are brave enough to pick up, leave a life that they know for an absolute unknown and create a new life. And I look at New York and I think that's what New York is.
Absolutely.
Everybody here is grit, and they are really the best of that pioneer adventure. And your mother certainly expresses in the way she lived her
she
life.
She is the manifestation.
Is,
yeah, absolutely.
Totally.
I mean, go to any naturalization ceremony, right? And you will see the gratitude,
yeah.
the appreciation, that grit that you mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a reason why people are still coming to this country,
mm-hmm.
right? It is still
it's the best
absolutely
place.
Still the place where you can
yeah.
make your dreams come true, where you can
That's
pursue
it.
This American dream, where you can pursue economic mobility
yeah.
in a way that you this is almost impossible.
Absolutely.
In the same way
yeah.
any other country.
The minute any American starts to complain, there will be somebody who's not American who will tell you how crazy you are.
No, that's exactly right.
They will tell you, are you nuts?
No,
are you crazy?
Exactly. I just spoke of the earlier this year at the Global Business Summit in New Delhi. And you know, there's 4 million Indian Americans here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And there I am in New Delhi speaking at the summit, and I had a chance to meet the prime minister, et cetera. And it's amazing when you hear the stories even over there about how fortunate we are here.
Yeah.
How fortunate
but
we are
it's
here.
People from, I mean, everywhere will tell you, like, there is, that's it. That's where you can make it. And do you have children?
I do. I have a 27-year-old son and a 23-year-old daughter. They are the love of my life. Absolutely.
And how did they react to your mom? What was their relationship with? Because I think every other generation have this amazing connection.
It couldn't be closer.
Yeah.
It couldn't be closer. I was the fortunate one where my mom actually lived with me.
Ah.
And so I was also the fortunate one where my kids were born and she was there as part of my village. I don't know how people do it otherwise. I really don't.
Mm.
And so I was very, very, very close to my mom. And so to have her be with me as part of this village, again, you know, beyond grateful.
Mm.
And so both my kids, you know, when she first got sick, when she first had her first stroke, you know, they dropped everything and came out, of course. Both of them, when she had her latest seizure, dropped everything, of course, and came
mm-hmm.
out. That's just the way they are. And even when I had to tell them, when I was on the plane heading home, and I had to tell them that she had just passed. And they were bawling. There I am on the plane, and my kids are bawling on the phone. We're FaceTiming. And it impacted them a lot. And still, very
yeah.
much so.
But as you will know and experience, that I learned with my mother, she will be around you and you will feel her and know that she's there.
Oh, absolutely. No. Again, right. You know, I'm not exactly a ghost kind of person. But if you walk into my house right now, it's an altar to her. Still, the storyboards are in my house and I haven't taken them down yet. And I don't know when. I'll take them down when I'm ready.
All right.
But not yet.
But you'll absolutely feel her energy. There's strong energy that
I feel it. And if you met my kids, you would see it more so in them. Again, look, I was very fortunate to have her in my life. I was also very fortunate to have my in-laws. I'm not married, but my in-laws at the time, and they lived and breathed for my kids. And so I called them the Breakfast Club. My mom was living with us, and my in-laws would come over every day at 7 a.m.
I love it.
And the Breakfast Club was, you know, alive and well. And you know, look, I think the best way to explain it is too many ways, but one of the first ways that I really saw it was when my son was applying to college, and he one of his college essays was called A Tale of Two Grandmas, and he starts off the essay by saying, "I am Joey," and he goes on about his grandmother from Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico, and his grandmother from Hokkaido, Japan, never once talking about their differences, but talking about how they both raised them with common values, mm-hmm. of family, food, faith, and unconditional love. And he ends the essay by saying, "I am Joey." You might see him as one versus the other, mm-hmm. but he is a product of all of it, a combination of all
that's
his experiences.
Beautiful.
That
right? is so beautiful.
And I think that's probably a great way to think about this next generation mm-hmm. of millennials and post-millennials. And we talked about those boxes mm-hmm. earlier. They don't want to check a box.
Yeah.
So when it comes to kind of, you know, how they identify, how they think about institutions, it's very, very different, yeah. right? And I think the reason is because anyone born in the mid-90s and later was born with the internet. So access to information changed everything,
yeah.
right? And so it's no longer what they're taught at home or what they're taught in the classroom.
Right.
It's what they see. It's what they can look up. It's what they know or don't know, right? The good, the bad, the ugly of the internet. But for them, it's, you know, it's complete optionality and fluidity. Mm. And that's going to be the same whether it comes to religion, partisan politics, mm-hmm. gender, ethnicity. So you can't really box them.
Yeah.
And so as we talk about these boxes, which we started to talk about at the beginning, they don't want the boxes.
No. And what you also profoundly described is family. And it can be, you know, a family you create. It
Absolutely.
Can be a family that's blood family, a family of friends.
Absolutely.
It could be a work family, family in whatever form it comes, and there can be many in your life, are so valuable. The structure of having people who care about you and that you feel a part of is really meaningful, and I think that's one of the areas we need to recognize and to say, if you don't have a family, you can create one. You can find ways of having your breakfast club or your village.
Absolutely.
But a lot of people are lonely right now.
Especially since the pandemic. Absolutely.
Like incredibly lonely. Yeah. I've had doctors on the podcast and talking about loneliness in a way that I think we've never really recognized as serious before.
Yeah.
And the importance of your story that you just told right now, I really want to emphasize it because it's a way to not think about loneliness, not think about being alone,
yeah.
The fear of that place is quite scary.
Absolutely, and I think that's exactly what it is. It is fear. And what's the counter to fear is courage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And finding the courage to get out of your own skin,
yeah.
get out into the real world, however you want to describe
yeah.
that, right? And so I think that is the one thing that was so powerful with my mom is that ability to take strategic risks,
mm-hmm.
right? And to get out of your comfort
yeah.
zone. Get out of your comfort
yeah.
zone. There is nothing comfortable
right.
about anything that she did, not once, not
yeah.
ever. And that is something that I try to ingrain in my kids all the time. You know, if you met my daughter, my God, she's the one.
Mm-hmm.
When you meet my son, his name is Joey. He's my pride and Joey. Absolutely. But when you meet my daughter, okay.
Mm.
Then you'll understand how the world works.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like she came out that way, but I also think that we also did have to harness a little bit more. Her village, you know, with the Breakfast Club is really interesting because they all lived and breathed for her. They all really did. And I would describe her coming out as very regal. That's the best word to describe mm-hmm. her. And at one point I had to make the conscientious decision to get her out of what I called at that time the Forbidden City, mm-hmm. because it was just too much on this one person, and it was time to get her socialized.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the challenge was that she wouldn't want to socialize with other kids. She didn't want to get out into the play date structure because she had this unconditional, who doesn't want what she
has. No.
And so I'll never forget coming home one time from work, and she was probably 3 years old, maybe turning four. And I walk into the house, and there is one grandparent feeding her, or one grandparent, she had her arms out, one grandparent putting on her coat, and the grandparent was putting on her shoes to take her outside into the backyard. I'm like, nope, this isn't going to work. She knows how to do all of that. And I am so grateful to my in-laws and my mom for what they did with her. She's perfection beyond perfection. Right. But I knew it was time.
Right.
Even we have to get her to be more perfect. And so that's when I started Montessori for her. Best thing I ever did. Started her in Montessori, where she met some friends. And then through those friends, she met this one friend that became her best friend. And it was her best friend that wanted her to start dance with her.
Ah.
So I got to tell you, it was dance that got her out of this bubble, got her out of her own skin. And she became a completely different person. It was the best thing I ever did.
That the universe takes us to where we're supposed to go.
Absolutely.
So back to your education.
Yep.
So now, what were your interests and where did you decide to really focus your education?
Yeah, so, I went to Harvard and so it's a liberal arts school, and they didn't really have a lot of vocational programs, so that they don't even have accounting, for God's sakes. And so
that's why I'm asking you this question.
I always thought I'd be a lawyer. I wanted to be a family lawyer.
Okay.
Until my junior year in college, and then I realized that I had more of an interest in community building and kind of bricks and mortar in a strange way, and real estate was kind of what piqued my interest. And so, strangely enough. And so, but my major, I was actually the first person in Harvard's history ever to combine the two majors that I combined. They didn't want to choose. Why choose when I could do both? Mm-hmm. So I combined sociology and romance languages and literatures, first time ever. And it was very difficult because you have two different departments that you have to satisfy. And in the end, you have to write an honors thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And your thesis is going to be graded as if the other department didn't exist,
which
is very, very challenging. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the second that I got that process formalized, others came behind me, which is really great.
Mm-hmm.
So it started something.
Yeah.
But I will say what really opened my eyes at Harvard and the experience that I had that I think and still is to this day in place is something, look, when you turn 18, anyone turns 18, that is usually when you start making your own decisions, right? It's usually when you go off to college, you start voting, mm-hmm. you open up your own checking account, you even choose what you want to eat for the very first time in your life.
Right.
And so that experience of having that independence for the very first time, and look, I was, practically in a cage my whole life, right, in terms of the life that I had before mm-hmm. I went off to school, which is why I made the choice that I did, going to the other side of this country, this foreign land of Cambridge, Massachusetts, out of my comfort zone, right? But boy, did I dive right in. And for a lot of people, it is their introspective.
Mm-hmm.
It is when they look at themselves for the very first time as an individual. And I realized that I actually loved the cultural parts of what I was leaving behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided as a freshman that I dove into, Harvard had a folk dancing, Mexican folk dancing group called Ballet Focorico. And so I dove right in.
I loved it.
I ended up becoming the director of it. But here's what was so funny, is those first 2 years, your freshman year, sophomore year, we had these great performances. It was usually Cinco de Mayo, something like that. But we practiced every week, and I thought there had to be more of an opportunity
mm-hmm.
to share this beautiful expression.
Right.
So it took me a couple of years, but with the help of, I mentioned Lisa Kuras, the one who helped me think about getting into Harvard in the first place. know, so she was there. She got me a job in the admissions office where I worked all 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
She was also kind of my champion with what I started at the Harvard Foundation. And Dr. Alan Counter at the time was the director. I started Cultural Rhythms. And Cultural Rhythms was a way for the campus to come together as a day of expression, however you wanted to find culture. Now, look, back then, you know, we had our Bali Folklorico. Maybe we had a Chinese group, Chinese dancing group. And maybe we had, you know, a cappella. That was Harvard's culture. Yay. Mm-hmm. We brought them in.
Right.
We had to go out of the community where we got a Greek Orthodox folk dancing group and a couple others, because we had to cobble this together.
Right, right.
But it started in the spring of 1986.
Wow.
And it goes to this day. It still goes on to this day. And here's the thing about culture. How I define culture, it's the threads of the fabric of a community that come together, mm-hmm. however you want to define culture.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, when I know I made a difference, I was invited back every year after I left, every year. And I remember coming back, I think it was the 10 year anniversary of Cultural Rhythms. Mm-hmm. And it's this performance piece, and it's also a food festival. And the food festivals were a lot of the student groups were actually able to raise money for the year, mm-hmm. which was really great. And it grew. It's now an audition. It's 2 days. It's amazing.
God.
I know, it grew. But here's the beauty of it. When I think it was the 10 year anniversary, when I went to Memorial Hall where the food festival was, I walked in, and the first thing I saw was the world's largest rainbow cake. And I thought to myself, oh my God, they get it. They get it. It's not just about ethnicity.
Right.
It's not just about race. It's not just me dancing for you.
Right. It's including
how can one feel comfortable enough to express themselves and feel like they're part of this village.
Yeah.
That's what culture is.
Yeah, it
totally
is.
And so I'll tell you what happened. It's another great, great story. Maybe at the 20-year reunion, because it's been going on now for a long time. At the 20-year reunion, and this is when I was being honored, I think, and this is when they actually retired one of my dresses from the Ballet of Folklorico, and they gave it to me.
God.
I still have it. It's in my closet. I have it. But so they brought in, you know, at that time, Harvard just started its own mariachi. Its own mariachi at Harvard. I think it's called Veritas. I think that's what it's called. I'm like, oh my God, it has mariachi. Isn't this great? And so they come in and they're performing for me, which is really nice. But I noticed, ready for this, that both violinists were Asian. I thought, well, this is interesting.
Oh, wow.
Right? This is interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, wait a minute. I got to talk. So after they performed, it was really nice. And I went up and I thanked them. I said, look, it's so great that Harvard now has mariachi. Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought?
Right.
And so I said, look, I got to ask you guys this question. What inspired you to join this group? Did you know of this music before you came here? And they said, no, absolutely not. They said, one of them was, you know, my roommate was in the Ballet Folklorico, and they told me about them. They're thinking about starting this mariachi. And I thought, well, interesting, fun. Yeah, sure, why not?
So I joined. The other one said,
he said, look, I've been doing classical music my entire life. Here I am, making my own decisions, heard the music, totally out of my wheelhouse. Why not? Why not? But look, so to have the ability to go, again, out of your comfort zone, to do what is so unexpected,
right,
so unexpected, and then own it, you're going to spend your personal time doing this is amazing.
It's the formula for success. I really believe it. When you take chances, or, you know, so many people here will say to me, Norma, I've never done this before. You really want me to do it? It's like, I haven't done it before either. This is new for me.
It
was trying new things.
That's the magic.
And that's it.
That's the magic.
And though that's a great story, you know, the visual of it is so perfect.
Wait, one more. Because this happened at the 30-year anniversary.
Oh my God.
So there's more. So again, I go all the time. And it's really, really fun. I haven't been in a while since COVID. They had to put a stop. And I think the last MC, the last host, I think was Lady Gaga, I think. But the first one was Debbie Allen.
Stop.
Amazing, 1986.
Oh,
how beautiful is that? I love her. So, but anyway, the 30-year reunion. I'm backstage. I think I was hosting. I can't remember. I was backstage, and I was meeting one of the groups that was practicing, and it was a group called the Harvard Thud. Thud was an acronym for the Harvard Undergraduate Drummers, and what it was, ready for this? It was a group of percussionists who who all had their own kind of skill sets, but they made cups. They made music with those cups, you know, those plastic cups.
Yeah.
It was like a symphony. It was crazy stuff what they were doing. I said, look, I gotta ask you guys, because this is a little unusual. It's amazing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So talented, all of you.
Right.
What made you do this? And they're all the founders of this, by the way. They're all the founders of the Harvard
Thud. Yeah.
And they all had similar stories to what the violinist said. I used to be a drummer. I used to be a, you know, whatever it was. We're all percussionists, but we all thought, you know what? Done. Let's do something different. And this is what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Together they come and they find their creative outlet.
Yeah.
That's culture. And they're all, by the way, white. So, right, again, look, it doesn't matter what you look like, who you are.
If you love it.
How you wanted to find culture, that's the theme. That's what has to sustain itself. And that's the best part of our country is we are kind of a nation of nations. We are this beautiful experiment, social experiment of all these cultures coming together. Yeah. And how do we take that and advance that?
It's a, you know, it has to be the way we look at coming back together again. I think that we sort of are going through the stress that's separating us and stressing us out.
That's right.
But, and I have a great belief in this country and in all that's possible and in the character of the people that are here, because everybody's an adventurer, right? Everybody either was a pioneer or they came here.
Unless you're indigenous or unless you're brought here without your permission, right? Everyone came here to build their dreams.
And then when you're here, there is an opportunity to bring us back together.
Yeah.
You know, I say this a lot. When I was growing up on the news, there was Martin Luther King, JFK, Gandhi, and Gandhi, right? Yeah. And not perfect, imperfect men, but the inspiration and the idea of bringing people together, loving one another, appreciating what we give to each other. We are missing out on that. Part of it is we're on our phones. Part of it is we're not touching. We're not hugging each other and
the
doing
connection
the
is lost.
60s and 70s.
Absolutely.
Are all hanging on to each other.
Absolutely.
We need to find a way, whether it's dancing again and everybody dancing more and doing that together, but we need to bring back that exchange of experiences that you can only have when you have a friend who eats a different way, does things in a different way, and then you experience it and you think, wow, I can have that.
That's exactly
I can feel that.
So let's go back to that time period, because I think you're leading up to something very, very important. Like one of my first memories, of course, was Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy Jr. Getting shot. I mean, of course, I remember that. But I also remember, you know, of course, I remember the Vietnam War, you know, the tail end of it. And of course, what happened with Nixon. And then what happened? So we were leading up to a very tumultuous time in our history. Very, very tumultuous time. And we were still evolving in many, many ways. Women were finding their voices. Mm-hmm. You know, again, that Equal Credit Opportunity Act didn't even pass till 1974, mm-hmm. where you could even apply
for your credit card. Well, when did women start to vote?
Technically, 1920.
Yeah.
Technically, 1920. But even, you know,
the
Civil Rights
time
Act.
To catch
Civil
up.
Rights
yeah.
Act, right, in the 60s also helped. In parts of the South, et cetera. But leading up to that period in the 70s, there was a moment where the country came together. Do you remember what that was for?
Well, I think there were a couple of, I think there were a couple of important periods that, whether it's the war that brought us together or the feeling of, I think the feeling of love and peace was possible, that the population believed that love and peace was possible.
Absolutely. And music was a big part of that.
Yeah.
Music was a huge part of that,
big,
right?
Big part.
Absolutely. What was coming from LA, what was coming from here, absolutely. Music was a big part of that. So there was this kind of cultural revolution that happened. Again, you know, the African American community found their voice as well. But then leading up to what became, and hopefully we're going to talk about this, the bicentennial of 1976. Now, I want to hear your memories of the bicentennial, because I remember it like it was yesterday, but I want to hear yours.
Well, I'm looking forward to your conversation about the bicentennial, because for me, I love the idea of a celebration, and that we're such a young country. Yeah. And I remember it actually from a fashion perspective.
Yes.
Because I was thinking, how can I express what this incredible time Absolutely. In history is about? And I kept, interestingly enough, I kept thinking about the indigenous people.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about how important it was that there were people here who were the first owners,
Absolutely.
the first people
Yep.
of this country. And then the flow of different cultures. So I found myself really expressing different cultures in the clothing. And I'm not a designer who typically has a theme like India or, you know, but I found myself doing things that really related to cross cultures, the multiculture aspect of the country. And I am specifically remembering certain things. And of course, everybody was doing flag things. And 76 in New York was an interesting time. It was a very, very rough time in New York. The city had really gotten beaten badly. People couldn't afford to live in the city, so they were leaving the city. There were strikes and all kinds of problems. And a lot of young, creative people, gay people, who's gay? Whoever heard of gay? Somebody that didn't find comfort in their hometown could come here because it was so cheap, because it was so dangerous. And the city filled with creativity. People from all over, and women who found feminism in their own description, either left their marriages, left where they were, and created an identity in New York. And so in 76, New York was on fire of creativity. And Studio 54
yeah.
opened.
Yeah, sure.
It was,
yeah.
and that was the place everybody could go to express themselves. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very creative time in New York. Mm-hmm. And there was a real celebration. There were concerts and all kinds of things happening at Studio 54 and in the city. There was a real celebration for how New York, in its most creative time, expressed that period. Mm-hmm. Now, your story here is...
Well, I mean, first of all, I remember the bicentennial like it was yesterday. I was 11 years old in Hayward, California. And look, in fifth grade, you know, that's when you start learning about American history. And so I still remember every patriotic song that we were taught. I am not going to say it. I still have, actually I carry it with me. I still have my bicentennial quarter. 25 cents for me back then was my life savings, but I have that and I found it now a year ago. And I have it. I carry it with me. And again, you know, I remember very clearly seeing the tall ships on our black and white TV coming through
Absolutely.
The New York Harbor.
Absolutely.
That was a global image.
Yeah.
That wasn't just a New
yeah.
York image.
Yeah.
That was a global image. Here's my
bicentennial
quarter. There
God,
it is.
Girl.
There it is. There it is.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, that's
yes.
Cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And I remember we took a field trip to the Oakland train station where they had the Freedom Train. Right, the Freedom Train brought the national treasures around the country, and my mom, you know, we never would have been able to go to D.C. ever in a million years. So the fact that it came to us,
wow.
Right? So my memories are of, and of course I'll never forget July 4th, 1976. It was a cloudy night in the Bay Area. But boy, those fireworks were the fireworks of all fireworks. And when you're an 11-year-old kid,
right.
That is, you know, a kid from nothing. I never felt more proud to be an American than that night, ever. Thinking to myself, there I am in Hayward. My mom had already left my dad. You know, I was going to school. I loved my school. And it wasn't the worst life. And I kept thinking to myself, anything was possible.
Mm-hmm.
There is something very empowering
yeah.
about having the eyes of the world watching your mm-hmm. country, that this is the place where every dream is possible.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I felt. And I want my kids to feel that. I do feel like that's missing in terms of an appreciation of where we've come from,
mm-hmm.
but more importantly, where we can go.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yes, yeah, so I was appointed by Senator Schumer to be a member of this congressional commission called America 250 in 2018. So this congressional commission, it's a 24-member commission established by legislation,
mm-hmm.
by Congress, and the 24 members are populated by the House and Senate majority and minority leaders, so half Democrat, half Republican, and it also includes, of the 24 members, 8 standing members of Congress, 4 from the House, 4 from the Senate. Well, last year, President Biden appointed me as chair. So who would have thought that this little 11-year-old girl who was loving life, celebrating the 200th anniversary of our nation's founding or Declaration of Independence, is now leading the nation's efforts. And here's the irony. In 1986, I was actually Harvard's class representative for their 350th anniversary.
Wow.
So in 2026, which is when our country turns 250 years old, which is, again, based on the signing of the Declaration mm-hmm. of Independence, is Harvard's going to turn 390 years old.
Wow.
So how ironic. And of course, no one knows this, by the way. It's not like anyone knew this
wow.
when I was appointed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is kind of a strange destiny, if mm-hmm. you will. And I'm embracing this. I'm all in. And it couldn't be going better. So, you know, we did have some challenges out the gate way back when. But I feel like we're on track to have the most comprehensive and inclusive commemoration and celebration this country and this world has ever seen. You know, look, I mean, you know, while we are not the world, the world is us,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you go back to 1776, you know, Alaska was Russia.
Yeah.
California
yeah.
was Mexico.
Yeah.
Right? Hawaii was its own kingdom.
Yeah.
We had our country double its footprint with the Louisiana Purchase in 1801 mm-hmm. with France and Spain. And so, you know, again, unless you were indigenous or unless you were brought here by force, you know, we all are experiencing this
mm-hmm.
in a very different way. And I want this to be something for everyone. I really do. And I'm hoping mm-hmm. more than anything. I don't think it's an accident that the president would pick someone who's a daughter of immigrants. Or I don't think it's an accident that he'd pick someone born and raised in Silicon Valley. The technology component that's going to be integrated into all of this is going to be
yeah.
key. Again, this is as much about the future as it is the yeah. past. And it is about my kids. Absolutely.
So when you're thinking about a plan or how you want this to evolve and develop, who is funding it?
Yeah, so thankfully, we have tremendous support from Congress, amazing support. In fact, we now have, you know, of the members of Congress, of our commission, they've actually been our champions, huge champions. I've met with all the appointing officials, their offices. So McConnell, Schumer, former leader McCarthy, and leader Jeffries, they all want this to be successful. All of them submitted videos
That's
on our
great.
Behalf, except for McConnell, who wasn't well. But they all made it very clear that this has to work.
Mm-hmm.
This has to work. And we've received our appropriations. But I've also made a commitment. Look, I'm a fiscal conservative. I think that corporate America has to be part of this.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We cannot rely on government funding to make this successful. So this is one of the reasons why I'm here in New York for the week, is that I am meeting with our those who expressed an interest, We have a great programming framework that we're going to announce very, very soon. Since I became chair, we've had a quorum every single meeting. It's been amazing. And so far, I don't know if you've heard, but we've actually launched our very first public initiative this last 4th of July called America's Invitation on America250.org. So America's Invitation is exactly that. It's inviting the American public to share their story, mm-hmm. their video, their memory, their suggestion and how we should be highlighting mm-hmm. this milestone. And then our first public historical milestone is actually coming up in Boston. It's the 250th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party on December 16th.
Oh,
so man. I am taking the commission out of the DC bubble, out of the Philadelphia bubble, and to where the action is. Yeah. We are having our commission meeting in December in Boston. We are absolutely participating and actually making some very big announcements, huge announcements about what we're doing. And what we're doing is we're using these regional meetings, these quarterly meetings, mm-hmm. to make our regional and local announcements, our community partners, our Boston partners, and of course highlighting what's happening mm-hmm. with the Tea Party. So when we launched America's Invitation on July 4th, we launched in partnership with our community partners. So that's Nextdoor, which is a social media platform for neighborhoods. They're our community partner.
Awesome.
YWCA.
Great.
And Major League Baseball. So when we launched intentionally in the great state of Wisconsin, a nice purple state. we launched at the Milwaukee Brewers against the Chicago Cubs game, baseball hot dogs and apple pie, and mm-hmm. a light touch to let people know that it's a 3-year count up, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
July 4th, 2023 is a 3-year count up to July 4th, 2026. And so now using these regional announcements as from a historical perspective,
right.
but also again, building the momentum from sea to shining sea. I say from mm-hmm. Fairbanks to Philadelphia, this has to be grassroots.
Yeah.
It has to be Main Street.
And so how do people learn more about it and get involved? I think the more people that are involved and have an experience
Absolutely.
With what you're doing, we will benefit as a country from that spirit being brought together. And if anybody can build the spirit within every American soul, you certainly are the capable one.
Oh my goodness.
I can't even think of anyone near a second.
Oh my goodness.
But I think you're positive energy, and everybody clearly will know you're going to get the job done. And people like success. And I'm sure if you wanted volunteers or people to be a part of this, there should be a way that they could
absolutely.
So we'll put up whatever.
Absolutely. America250.org is our website. And again, as we make these regional announcements and we start to announce what our programming framework is going to look like, again, we are soliciting ideas already from America's Invitation. And America's Invitation was really informed by, I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm the one that initiated and led the effort to place the portrait of a woman on our Federal Reserve notes for the first time in our country's history. So we had a public engagement process. I don't know if you remember, in June of 2015, we launched, when I was Treasury of the United States, we launched a very ambitious public engagement process that has never happened in any administration, where we used Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, emails, letters, roundtables for almost a year, soliciting feedback from the American public and should be considered for our currency. And that led to the announcement of Harriet Tubman on the $20
wow.
bill in
yeah.
April 2016. That is what made me realize that this has to be out in Main Street.
Yeah.
This has
yeah.
to be, again, grassroots. This has to be
yeah.
all of us being able to see themselves mm-hmm. in this commemoration. Have you had a chance to see our video that we launched?
No.
I will play it for you when we're done because it is absolutely
well,
amazing.
Well, we can attach
absolutely.
It to
Absolutely. It's amazing.
So, yeah.
So that video, I think, is a great product of the process that we're using. So what we're making sure is that, again, everyone can see themselves in everything that we do. It is not going to be perfect, and we can't be all things to all people.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you a great example. So clearly, we needed extra capacity to make sure that we're focusing on the right themes, the right messaging,
mm-hmm.
the right articulation of what we're trying to accomplish. And so I created what I'm calling our professional services team, which is a set of outside consultants who focus on public initiatives and focus groups and research, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
They've been amazing. And it's Republican and Democrat. It's all sides of the aisle are
right.
together in this. And so the beauty of this is, you know, I literally say, you know, we want to do a video. Here's the concept, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to know how the sausage is made, but I'm not going to see it
right
until you all agree on how this is going to look. And then it still evolves from there. And I got to tell you, this video is as perfect as one could get in terms of hopefully capturing the essence of right. what we're trying to do right. here with American 250. So when you see it, hopefully you'll agree.
Right.
But that's the process we're going to have to use. We have to be very methodical, very deliberate, very thoughtful in our messaging and how we want to make sure this is an open door.
Mm. And so in what would you, now you remember as an 11-year-old, what that image was yeah. for you.
Yeah.
So what do you want an 11-year-old to experience in this new version? And we could talk about
yeah.
AI and
yeah, sure.
What would you want her or him to take away?
Yeah. So I think you said one word that was going to be the most important word that I could ever think of, which is connection. So, you know, we have to feel like we're connected to something. It has to be something there for everyone.
Right.
And everything I do, you're going to find, is always tactile. There's a physical component to everything that I do, because your brain synapses react very differently when
right.
you touch something.
Absolutely.
You get into what I call the third dimension,
yes.
right? So when you touch a person, a thing, whatever, your brain gets into this emotional,
very much,
emotional
yeah.
place. So that connection is going to be very, very key. And so, you know, people ask me all the time, how do you know you're successful in 2026? I want as many Americans as possible to feel like this is the land of opportunity all over again. You have to feel it. And the way you're going to feel it is through connection, no doubt in my mind. So, and that's going to mean very different things to very different people. And everyone has to own mm-hmm. their ability to connect to this, right? What it means for the past mm-hmm. and what it means for the future. And look, I'm approaching this as a very kind of all-partisan, non-partisan, bipartisan perspective. Mm-hmm. It has to be that.
Yeah.
Then no matter who's in office, whether it's in Congress or the
right.
White House, no matter who's in office
it has to hold
in 2026, which is why we're doing mm-hmm. the public process.
Right.
Right. So when we develop this playbook, and the playbook, again, is happening as we speak, mm-hmm. that hard copy of that playbook is going to be delivered to Congress and the White House in January mm-hmm. of 2025. Right. Whoever's in office in January 2025 in the 24 election, we can say America has
yeah.
spoken.
And that and I think an important part of that would be the generational differences, and each of the way they look at this, and making sure that they're all feeling a part of it, connecting.
Absolutely.
Because it's clear that Gen Z and millennials
yeah.
are so different
yes.
in the way they operate, the way
yeah.
they look at things.
Yeah.
And baby boomers, I actually think in some odd way that I connect as a baby boomer to Gen Z, and that they seem to connect to me in a certain way. And there's a...
That's exactly right. And you know why that is? No, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, again, look, I mean, from you, you know, I keep saying when I grow up, I want to think like them. I keep saying when I grow up, I want to be my daughter. I say that all the time because they see the world in a very fluid way. A very open way,
mm-hmm.
a very global way.
Yeah.
It's no longer competing against the kid sitting next to them in class,
right.
They're competing against Russia and China,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
So they see the world in a very global approach. And it's very liberating how they think, very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of freedom of thought is similar to what happened, I think, in the 60s and 70s,
yeah.
where our country evolved in a very
yeah.
similar way.
It was revolutionary. We were landing on the moon.
Exactly.
Ideas. I was working on a UNIVAC computer in the 60s, so it was the first time anything would be thought of in that way. So there is a similarity, but
it's a creativity more than anything. It's a creativity,
right? And so the tactile part of it, how are you going to achieve that one?
Yeah, so let me just start by saying the legislation is very prescriptive in terms of what we can and can't do, but one of the things that it does highlight that we do have to do is a time capsule. Of course, absolutely, we're doing a time capsule. So you know, we think that a time capsule is probably, it could be technology-based, or it also could be, you know, a mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
Something from every state. It could be something very interesting and,
mm-hmm.
and again, you know, again, the threads of the fabric of this mm-hmm. community, whatever that looks right. like, there does have to be a tactile component, and there will be a technology component. It has to be both.
Yeah.
Has to be both.
Absolutely.
And so I will say, though, that one thing we also have done is something that I worked on for a number of years, which is, I don't know if you've seen the Historical American Women on Quarter series, mm-hmm. but it's a 10-year program where it's going to be, so the first quarter that was issued last year, in January of last year, it was Maya Angelou. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the mm-hmm. first time in U.S. history that an African-American woman has been depicted on our coin or currency. And so that's a part of a 10-year program. It took me 5 years to pass that legislation. Thank you to Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman, Speaker Pelosi was also very, very supportive. We passed this legislation. Wow. 5 years of my life it took me to pass this. But it's a 10-year program. So it's 4 years of women on quarters, five per year. So 20 women will be highlighted. I have some for you, by the way. I want you to pick and choose.
How exciting.
Yes. And then it turns into 1 year of our semi-quincentennial quarters. It's called semi-quincentennial, the 250th. And so our quarters will be included in that. In fact, all circulating coins will be redesigned for the 250th. And then it turns into 4 years of youth sports.
Wow.
Why did I choose that? Why did we choose that?
Wow.
Because I want kids to see themselves. And I think sports, like I did for my kids, is a great way to engage kids. So what do kids collect these days? You tell me what they collect these days. When I grew up, we collected what?
Cards.
We collected cards. Yeah. We collected stamps. We collected, I collected bubble gum wrappers. Mm. But what do kids collect these days? They collect likes and followers,
oh,
right?
Yeah, I was going to say
right?
social media.
Right?
Social
and,
media.
And, you know, baseball cards are making right. a comeback,
yeah,
et cetera.
But still.
Everything that I do, if you ever see, you know, when I found my voice as an accidental feminist, accidental educator, right. accidental historian, every initiative that I do always has a physical component. Always.
Has to.
So yeah. So those 4 years of youth sports is going to be key, again, for kids, boys and girls,
yeah.
to find themselves,
yeah, definitely.
Right? And then it ends with, it gives the U.S. Mint the ability to produce the Olympics, the medals for the Olympics in 2028. So this is a global effort, by the way, because in 2026 is also the World Cup, right? Where 11 cities in the U.S. will host the World Cup.
That's
so we are
right.
coordinating with FIFA.
That's
there is
right.
a national international platform here. And again, these themes of democracy, which are all partisan, by the way, which is a big theme for me,
mm-hmm.
the theme of democracy will continue on through 2026 onto the Olympics of 2028 in LA. So this country is going to be in the spotlight on a global lens for a long time. This isn't a one and done.
Yeah.
This is not about an event.
This
is
the
great. Journey. This is the journey.
This is great. And I think for something as powerful as what you're doing, which it just isn't a celebration, I think this is realigning Americans,
our nation's values,
to believe in the opportunities we have here and to find the one voice on how we can join together,
yeah.
make it happen.
Yeah.
And if anybody could get us to get together. But you're so right. It can't be one thing
yeah.
and then it's over.
Yeah.
It's like a wedding and then all that effort, what happened? This is a continuing build.
It has to be.
And reinforcement. And I think children, especially Gen Z,
yeah.
desperately are looking for a connection.
Yeah.
They are the most disconnected,
absolutely.
I think, from their identity
yeah.
as Americans.
Yeah.
And I think that they will find a creative way
yeah.
to express that.
Yeah.
And you will give them the platform
yeah. absolutely.
To do
and,
it.
And this is even beyond Gen Z, right? So technically
oh,
Gen
for sure,
Z, technically
but,
Gen
yeah.
Z, 1996 to 2010. But, you know, I think that whole concept of defining generations as 15 years is over.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's the internet that's really flattened that plane
yeah.
for all of us, right? So
yeah.
again, these kids that have access to everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But at the same time, they're much smarter from a content perspective
mm-hmm.
than we ever were at
yeah.
that same age. But they're also, it's much more challenging for them. Much more challenging
very,
in terms of,
very
of
difficult.
What they've been exposed
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
What their brains haven't quite understand that they've been exposed to. And how they're taking all this in a way that doesn't really allow them to see their future the the way they should be seeing it, right? So I am hoping that this is, you know, this, yes, we want to educate, we want to engage, we want to unite, but more than anything, I want to empower. I want to empower all of us to figure out what that collective voice looks like, and more importantly, find that individual empowerment, right? Believe in yourself, believe in this country, and believe in yourself.
The strength of that, I think, is going to be contagious. Tell me a little bit. I'm a big AI person.
Oh, yeah.
I have two projects that I'm immersed in, and I love it.
Yeah.
And I think this is an incredible opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, cat's out of the bag. It's not going back in.
No.
And people need to embrace this.
Yeah.
And what people don't understand about AI, it's been around for a long time. The reason why it's getting a lot more attention now is that it's being institutionalized and packaged in a way that's now going to be commercialized, right? And so how that works is, and what I think people are afraid of is that the technology is compounding so quickly, right? The generations of AI, you know, normally when you get from an iPhone, you know, 8 to 9, you know, wait a year or two.
Right.
A generation of AI is months.
Yeah.
It's months.
Well, look at, and we went from 3 to 3.5, we're at 4. And 6, 7, 8.
That's right. Around the corner. Yeah. All of it is around the corner. And so everyone's embracing it. And if you think about it, I mean, again, the challenge is, you know, people are nervous about how do you regulate this? How do you put the brakes on? How do you, you know, and it's really hard to do that. Again, it's already out there. And so as a business, but as a culture and as students, as all of this, this is an enormous opportunity, but there are responsibilities that come with it. Huge responsibilities that come with it. But it absolutely is. It's such an asset to what we're already doing. It's already been out there. Mm. But, you know, again, you just have to learn how to ride the wave.
Yeah. And it's the biggest thing that has happened for sure in my lifetime and beyond, that the biggest transformational change in our globe, in our world. And the opportunities are just going to
endless.
Be extraordinary.
Endless.
It's going to be bigger than the World's Fair, where my mother and father met in 1939, is what it's going
to
be.
Well, and on that note, it'd be great to see what does a World's Fair look like in 2026.
Well, that's exactly it.
That's it. So, and the technology, I'll tell you right now, whatever we're going to do doesn't exist right now. It doesn't exist.
And it will start to build as we speak.
That's right.
And evolve into, while it's happening, this magnificent experience that we're all going to have.
Yeah.
And I'm just so grateful that you were chosen, because if I didn't know you, which is why I want everybody to know you.
Oh,
if I didn't know you and somebody told me this is what they were going to do, I would say, that's nice. Okay, that's nice. It takes a super woman. It takes a super higher level human being. And I mean that in the most deliberate way, that you are that person, and
oh
I
goodness.
Think now everybody spent a little time with you will say, maybe we need to see how we can get involved with it, because is going to be amazing.
Well, thank you. We are going to likely do a formal process, which is going to be really great to open the door for all to see what these ideas are, because you know, when Nextdoor, the CEO of Nextdoor, reached out to me, Sarah Fryer, whom I adore, she reached out to me and she sent me this email. And in this email, she said, Nextdoor activated over 18 million people across Great Britain to organize the lunches as part of the Queen's Jubilee. And we want to do something similar for
really?
You all. And I'm thinking, how fabulous is that? Like, they have the technology. That's their skill set.
Yep.
That's their wherewithal.
Yep.
How perfect that they want to use that momentum on our behalf. So they are one of our partners. So if we want to do it, making this up, you know, United Taste of America, where we do some type of cookout on July 4th at 2 p.m., whenever it is, right? And they'd be great to organize something like that, whatever it is. So if there's proprietary technology that exists out there, I'm making this up, maybe, you know, from Star Wars, you saw the Princess Leia hologram. Maybe there's something like that that someone's working on. We could do a tour of Mount Rushmore from your home.
I'm making it up, but mm-hmm. I'm sure that technology is going to be compounded over time.
And meetups with a theme and, you know, have all of these things happening at the same time.
Exactly.
One of the things that that I think of when I think of large populations of people doing something at the same time and the impact it has. And every time I'm in the Middle East, and I'm also a Maronite Christian, but every time I'm in the Middle East and the call to prayer, five times, everybody stops, they say their prayer, and they continue. And my dream for New York is that 12 noon, 1 minute, that's it. We just stop. We don't have to pray. We just think for a minute. And I feel like this is an opportunity for us all at one time, maybe to celebrate, whether it's the Star Spangled Banner where we all do it at the same time, where we do things together.
That's right. That'll
just
definitely
like
happen.
Working out together,
exactly.
Doing things together has such an impact, and and that, and doing it with people that are from different cultures, different experiences, dressed in different ways, different generations.
Let's New York is going to be at the forefront of all of this for many, many reasons. One is, I don't know if people know this or not, but actually next year is the 400th anniversary of New York. That's one. So we're on this count up of, you know, next year is also the 250th anniversary of the First Continental Congress. So it's going to be a big year next year. All these historical milestones are going to be part of this. But New York, as you recall, is the first capital of our country.
Yeah.
And we have Federal Hall here. And let's not forget, of course, for me personally, 2026 is the 25-year anniversary of 9/11. That will absolutely be at the forefront of our commemoration. And our moment of reflection.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So so personally, obviously you're not afraid of adventure. You like to do lots of different things. Your energy is exciting and contagious. So personally, because we all want balance, right? What are your personal, I think especially after your mom passed, and I am remembering where I was at that time. What are you thinking about personally?
For 2026 or just
for
in general?
You, for you.
You know, it's all about my kids. So my mom was my life, and she still is. She still is my life. She still burns inside of me every day. But it is about my kids. And it is about my daughter specifically. You know, I have this phrase, you know, my son will be fine, my daughter has to climb. That absolutely is going to be the case. Mm-hmm. That's just, unfortunately,
that's the way it is.
That's just the way it is. But, you know, it's funny, growing up, my son, who is just such an amazing,
just fun, from that little the thing he wrote, I'm in love with him.
He's a great kid. But we've all agreed, you know, Joey, you know, when you grow up, you're going to make a great vice president to Berkey. Because she, you know, she's the one, and she came out that way, and she has this, she takes life by the horns in ways that I would never have been able to. You know, she was the only girl in the Boys Little League before we moved from California. We couldn't find a team in D.C. that would accept her because she was playing at such a high level for her age. So she gave up baseball and moved on to basketball. My little, you know, 5-foot pixie, 90 pounds on a good day, maybe at the time, developed this outside 3-point shot where she became the captain of the varsity girls basketball team in one of the most competitive public schools in the country, and, you know, and made the record for the most 3 points in a game. That's her. What is she doing now? She graduated 6 months early from UC Davis, and immediately, you know, I for her graduation, I gave her 400,000 miles. I said, go see the world. Go visit your friends who are still in school.
I love it.
You know, she did. She just put her head down and worked like crazy. She got into graduate school. She was still 21 when she started, and she's getting her doctorate in psychology with this intersection between mental health and sports. I mean, she's the world. She is. She is the future. And she's the most fun. She's such a joy. Both my kids, I call my son Joey, Joyous Joey. They're so much fun. Mm-hmm. And I said, they're the members, I call them the members of the 4-H Club.
head, health, humor, and heart. Just the best kids. There's nothing I would change about them.
Well, I clearly, you had your mother and they have you, and that is, you know, the gift you gave them is the ability to be those people. And that's what's so extraordinary. And I just am so lucky that I met you, and that your energy can be shared, and that you're going to impact this country. You already do, but I think this project and everything else you do.
Thank you.
I don't know how many people are going to want you to run for political office.
Never.
I just know that we need leadership that looks like you, acts like you, talks like you, thinks like you, and is as important to the survival of our history and our country. And I think you're the perfect person.
Gosh.
I'm thrilled.
You know how this was pitched to me? You gotta love this. So, I mean, I'm still working. I still have to work, and my daughter's in school. I'll never go when this was first pitched to me. And this person said to me, look, in the spirit of John Warner for the Bicentennial, Lee Iacocca for the Statue of Liberty, Michael Bloomberg for the 9/11, and Mitt Romney for the Salt Lake City Olympics, you will be the first woman to ever head a historical milestone of international significance in this country. And my first thought was, are you kidding me? First of all, they're all billionaires. Like, you know, John Warner was married to Elizabeth Taylor. I'm like, wait. Wait a minute. So they got to bring in their own teams. You know, I don't think any of them had to work in their congressional commission construct. They just came in and, you know, guns blazing. Right. I still have to, I'm a volunteer. I still have to work. I'm still doing my thing.
As the list was going on, I was like, okay, I got the theme. I get the theme, and then, okay.
Oh, my God.
That's creative.
So, but look, I mean, I was hesitant. I really was hesitant when I was first asked to do this. I was very hesitant just because, and my mom was ill at the time, and, but I'm all in. And you realize, I realized very, very quickly that one, our leadership wants us to work. All the appointing officials, Democrat and Republican, our members of Congress, our congressional caucus, our commissioners, they all don't just want this to work. They've made it very clear. It has to work.
It
has to work.
It's so true. I think at this time in history, and because I'm 78, I have a perspective here a little bit more than you might imagine, but at this time in the history of our country, this event, I think, could be an important glue, an important experience that we can all have together. And I know you're going to come up with I just know people will want to share ideas and participate, and I'm sure everyone who will listen to this, and I certainly am your humble servant.
Oh, you made me cry.
Need a hemstone,
ladies and gentlemen, Norma Cavalli.
I'm proud to be a New Yorker. I love the ability that I've led a creative life in this country. I came from humble beginnings. My mom was a single mom too, and we really did not have the privilege that anybody would think you would have to have. But I was so lucky to live this education. My mother is the same thing, but we have to make sure that that dream lives for other people too.
Absolutely.
We both are so lucky.
Absolutely.
And that I want to help you in any way I can.
Oh my gosh. Music to my ears.
And so many other people will.
Thank you.
To give me
oh my God, you're so sweet. Thank you.